on the theme of stories in science, as some of you are aware, I have gotten, over the last year or so, infatuated with the idea of story. And so what I took the opportunity to do was to sort of reflect on why I'm so infatuated with the idea of story. And so I thought I would give you a little reflection on why I'm so infatuated with the idea. Bring you up to date on some recent developments in the story of story. In the present context, I have pitched very hard the argument that science is story in a very important sense. There's an article which says science is storytelling and story revision. And I've made the argument here a couple of times. And I want to just sort of briefly review a whole bunch of stuff that we've talked about. And then carry the story forward a little bit. The thing in my mind, or at least in recent years, was focused around story as a way of thinking about science. But the argument I want to make for you is that the appeal of the term for me turns out to go way beyond science. And as I was thinking about it, it is appealing to me because it provides a way to talk not only about science, but about some other things that I've been interested in for a long time. So let me kind of give you the background quickly and then show you the extensions. The background roughly says there is no truth or reality available as a guide. Whether there is such a thing as truth, capital T, or reality, capital T, is an open question. But in any case, since we don't know what it is and can't know what it is, it doesn't provide an adequate foundation for proceeding in inquiry. One can't say, as people frequently do, oh, I am closer to it, because there's no way to measure the distance to it because you don't know what the hell it is. So there is no truth nor reality available as a guide. Because of the way the brain is organized, all that one ever has at any given time is a story. This follows from the fact that our understandings, our conscious activities, and they can only be created based on information that comes from the unconscious, and that information is always ambiguous. So there is a step of disambiguation or creativity or uncertainty, or something, which is always present in any given understanding.
Can I put a log down on the train track at this point?
yes, I may decline to deal with it at this point, but yes.
Because it's a big one. But this strikes me as a moment that parallels a certain kind of moment in a lot of postmodern epistemology, which is to say, a similar statement about truth or a similar kind of anti-foundationalism The problem is that it's a statement that's actually made as a foundational statement.
Yes.
And the same thing is true here. In other words, it is the statement is made, there is no truth or reality, or truth or reality can only be understood as a story. In other
yes.
words, whether they are anything else.
Yes.
That's a statement which, in a sense, excludes from possibility stories that need truth or reality as inadmissible, but by its own standards cannot actually exclude such stories. So it's a paradoxical no, and it's the same thing that in a lot of postmodernism leads to the paradox that it sounds permissive. In other words, it should open up an infinite ability to make stories, but ultimately is actually incredibly inhibitory, an almost authoritarian way. In other words, a lot of Derridean criticism always starts from the position that the only thing which one is not allowed to say is the thing which one is already saying.
Yes.
So that's a problem. In other words, it's not clear where you can get the ability to declare that the one story that is disallowed is the story in which we say our stories have something to do with truth.
I think in various ways respond to all parts of that. But I do absolutely agree that those first two points are indeed the quandary, if you like, of postmodernism. And in fact, one of these talks listed up here is actually called On Beyond
right,
Postmodernism.
I saw this, yeah.
So what I actually wish to do is not to end with these two points, but rather move from the two points.
Right. I would just say it's a beginning of the story that is difficult to supersede.
Actually, no, because the way this story gets told, these first two lines, actually admits of the possibility that there is truth or reality. It simply is saying you cannot; they're not available as guides.
Right. Ergo, one must not tell stories which
one
require them.
One must justify stories using them. It is conceivable that the process would get there, and there's a well-defined
way
it could get there.
But I would just point out that that's a statement that, in order to have the force that it has, actually needs to be the one true statement in the room.
The one true statement in the room is not that there is no truth nor reality. The one true statement is you cannot use them as a guide.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. In other words, but it becomes hard to say that by the very standard that the statement proposes.
Not quite, I don't think so. But in any case, I'm prepared to concede that any way of inquiring has to start somewhere. And so my challenge is to an old way of starting.
Right.
Does it need to be so strong, though? Couldn't you say that you don't necessarily need truth or reality as a guide?
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Okay. Okay. You can get to that from starting where
Part
you are.
Three
okay.
says, oh, this is actually all right. Because you don't need truth or reality. Okay? You can actually do exactly what we've been doing for the most part, substituting for the words truth or reality or movement towards them, substituting for them the words moving away from ignorance. Ignorance is well defined. Truth or reality is not.
Okay,
sure
I'll let you get to the third part before I throw more logs in.
Okay.
No, but the thing is, one of the things that will be interesting to see where you're going, because based on those three statements,
yes.
I think we're right back to the argument, and I don't want to drag this into it, but I can't help it, that's basically what the Kansas Board and intelligent design
yes.
people, which
we're
science, is anything you want to call it.
We're going to get
because
there.
Because
absolutely, no
right.
problem. We're
all
moving
right.
that direction.
But
okay.
science is anything you want to call it?
No.
Okay. You can get to an address.
We don't have truth and reality available as a guide. Because of the brain, it's all story. We don't need truth and reality. Getting rid of truth and reality has some very clear advantages. Among them is it would produce a major reduction in social conflict. Indeed, the argument basically says it would be a good idea to get rid of truth and reality if only because a major source of human suffering has been the reliance on concepts of truth and reality. So, the Crusades are one example. The rise of communism is an example. There are a whole series of them. So there would be social utility in getting rid of the concepts.
This is a really hard pill to swallow when we have to assume there's reality all the time.
We're coming to that point. Wait a minute. We're getting there.
On pure truth claim grounds, there are, of course, plenty of historians who would say none of those things that you attribute to being, you know, causally about conflicts over truth and reality actually have anything to do with that, that they're driven by underlying social issues, they're driven, you know, that the Crusades really aren't about ideology, they're about, you know, pure economics or whatever. I mean, so that there's also a problem here that one could actually say all the things which are perceived as being conflicts over representations of the truth or ontological claims are in fact misperceived, that they're really something else altogether.
I'm perfectly comfortable with it.
Meaning this might have nothing to do with
No, it has nothing to do with
conflict.
It. Lots of people who participate in them justify them to themselves.
Justify them, that's true.
So there's reason to get rid of the terms.
They may just fight on other grounds.
They may.
That's an entire possibility, right.
They may tell another story to fight.
If there's a deeper driver, they'll just...
They may. Furthermore, I think we can better understand both aspects of the mind-brain and social organization without these terms. That's fundamentally the emergence notion. The emergence notion says, you ain't going anywhere. You are where you are, and you move to the next step. There's no long-term driving force. All right. Having said all of that, the argument that I made 2 weeks ago was not only are they not available to us as guides, not only are there other reasons to think it would be desirable to get rid of them, these concepts, not only is it most consistent with an emergent perspective to get rid of them, but there is a way to proceed which deals with intelligent design versus blank, and all of these other problems. That is, getting rid of all of these says we cannot discriminate between stories using the concepts of truth and reality. That does not say that we can't discriminate between stories. It says we can't discriminate between stories that way. And it's at this point, as far as I'm concerned, appropriate response to the postmodernist position is not, you're wrong about the position, it's too hard, I can't deal with it. The appropriate response is, yes, you're right that it's all story. Yes, you're right that there's no truth, no reality that can be used to discriminate between stories. The question then becomes,
everybody, that nobody gets to stand on. Right,
you
got
it.
Yeah,
nobody
good.
Gets to stand on it. But that's not the end. That's the beginning.
Yeah.
It's at that point that you ask the question, how can you discriminate between stories in the absence of the concepts of truth and reality? That's the question. You don't throw up your hands and say, oh, you've pulled the rug out from under me. I can't move. You instead say, what you've said is you can't use this. That doesn't say that you can't discriminate between stories. It says you got to be clearer about a justifiable way to discriminate between stories.
Why should you want to?
Because
the
pure solipsist position is just not appealing. It's not attractive.
So it's inesthetic to be
it's both,
and unable to discriminate.
It's both
between
an aesthetic stuff. Issue and a practical issue.
An agency issue. You want to be able to act.
Yeah, you want to be able to act. People need something to stand on.
Well, you can still act if you can't discriminate between stories. You just act on the first one that occurs to you.
You could.
Which
don't
is
regard
a
it.
Principle of discrimination, I suppose.
All I'm saying at the moment
in the most
is
the animal world does.
That's right.
I am willing and inclined to hang on to the desirability of discriminating between stories. I don't believe it can be done in terms of truth and reality. Therefore, I want to figure out what it is that I do to discriminate between stories. It doesn't depend on the concepts of truth and reality.
It might have something to do with people wanting to convince
and
other people.
And I'm
too.
Then going to make the argument that, in fact, this way of discriminating between stories is, in fact, the way most people do it much of the time. And it is what accounts for the success of science, as well as for some other successes. So the inquiry is...
Sounds like a truth claim.
No, it's not going to be a truth claim. It is simply going to be the claim that an ability to discriminate between stories is desirable. We need to figure out what is the basis of that discrimination. That's all.
Well, when you talk about most people, which most are you talking about?
Let's not even worry about that. I'm going to worry only about me at the moment.
All right.
How do I discriminate between stories? Why would I rather have...
I would not put you in the class of most people.
Well, stay with me. Why would I argue that makes sense to teach evolution in schools, it does not make sense to teach intelligent design. That's a story discrimination. It's being done by me. I'm saying I can't do it based on truth or reality claims. I need to understand how I am doing it. What underlies it?
I'm satisfied on one level with the notion that the motivation for doing that is aesthetic. That one's good enough. I'm not clear what the practical motivation.
The practical one is I need to have for myself a justification for telling other people that the wish to teach intelligent design in classrooms is a jerk-off, and they should forget it.
Okay, but then that's a solipsistic practicum. In other words, it says the only reason I need what I need is because I need it. In other words, and my reasons for needing it are mysterious in some sense or inexplicable to others. I'm interested
They may not only be inexplicable to others, they may be inexplicable to me until I have thought about it.
What you're saying is in practical communicative terms, you need to be able to say to other people, this is why I am doing what I'm doing and arguing what I'm arguing, but there's no utilitarian practical that is being invoked beyond that. In other words, good results will follow from
That's
this.
Correct.
It's in a sense merely saying I have a need to in order to accomplish my perception that something good is happening from my particular preferred versions of stories to offer for communicative reasons a rationale that goes beyond I want it.
With one other addition, and that is if by communicative you mean interpersonal. No, in fact, I need it for myself.
Okay, that's fine too, right? In other words, there's one cognitive module that needs to talk to the other one or whatever, however you want to model that.
Bingo.
No, what's the opposition of that? I mean, isn't that all we're all trying to do all the time? I don't get the flip side of that.
The opposition...
What do you contrast that with?
The opposition to it is that it's purely instrumental. In other words, there would be...
Can't we deconstruct everything to that, though?
Yes, I think it's a view that then has some really serious consequences
if you accept it.
Yep. And I don't particularly like the consequences because it's a higher order version of a solipsism that says we all want whatever it is that we want. Our reasons for wanting it are, in one sense, permanently mysterious. We can't make truth claims about them. And we will all do whatever we can to maximize whatever those desires might be, we will do what we can that that will allow us to perceive that we're maximizing. I mean, it's a kind of Nietzschean position in some ways.
It's more than. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not kind of.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's
quite Nietzschean.
Yeah. So, I mean, the problem with that is the problem that I would have with that in any guise, but it's a consistent position. I have no quarrel with it.
My concern is you may be able to sleep well.
Paul
but
is not
that
chickening out
necess-
on the philosophical implications here. Most
Paul
people
is,
parachute out at some
Paul
point.
Paul is not only not going to chicken out.
Yeah.
Paul is going to stand on.
Right. No, he's drinking the Kool-Aid.
But you know, you may be able to sleep well having satisfied your own, come up with your own justification. But I, in the larger context of the bigger world and the bigger issue, I don't see how it helps anything.
Let's
but
look into how it helps other things. That's exactly
is
where
make
we
a
are.
Claim and say, then I'm going to stand on that.
I agree.
All right. But then you're a fundamentalist.
Secular fundamentalist.
All right.
Oh, all even right. Worse. Oh my God.
Are you a fundamentalist?
I'm not going to believe anything you say.
I would say I think there's a I wouldn't call it a happy medium. There's another position, and we talked about this some in the intelligent design thread, but. That in which you can make truth claims that are probabilistic ones rather than final ones. There are stories that are, I mean, this would be the way I work through this on a postmodern terrain, that it's right for Derridians and lots of others to knock out of the park the idea that a story ever means one thing, or that it has a right interpretation. It's not right to knock out the notion that there are more right interpretations and less right ones, and that in a sense here being accurate is a probabilistic relationship to truth, and that's all it can be by definition. In other words, one should never try to resolve it
we're left
past
wrong.
That so I accept in a sense the
inhibition. I don't think
you're
we're arguing. Let's go on.
That's
and
right.
pursue it.
You are arguing if what he's saying is accuracy is a probabilistic relationship.
Well, we are arguing, but there's a sense in which I would say it is unprofitable to tell stories, in this sense I go a ways down that list, in which the primary criteria for distinguishing between them is some fixed, final, and resolvable relationship between truth or reality, or the notion that one is increasingly converging on that fixed
yes,
relationship.
Either of those we have to get rid of. We're in agreement.
I mean, I would say it's a kind of Heisenberg theory of uncertainty in meaning and story interpretation that, you know, you...
It can be here, but it can't be out there.
Yeah.
Rather than hanging right here,
yeah.
Let's go through some of the rest
keep going,
of, the,
keep going.
Of the thing.
But I want to make sure that was clear.
And since, Tim, you weren't here earlier, let me just quickly back up.
Static versus labile, right?
This is the talk I did here.
Right, I read this one, because this was the background of that.
I'm perfectly prepared to concede the usefulness of some capacity to explain the world in a way that is predictably powerful, collective validator tested, that can be reconciled with other stories possessing similar qualities.
Yeah, we like that.
That one's fine. And we can all use it. It's good. But it's not actually an adequate basis for discriminating some stories that I'd like to discriminate. And so at the end of this whole thing,
okay, that's fine.
What
that
I actually said was
that this is relatively quickly exhausted as a principle of discrimination.
That's exactly correct. And so I added to this an additional principle, which I call generativity. One discriminates as a scientist between stories that had this character and that seem to open new questions and new stories, and stories that have this character that don't seem to do so.
Okay.
So the additional principle that I want to throw in, and I suggested throwing for the story discrimination, is generativity. And that one is fundamentally probabilistic, in the sense that I can make a bet that a particular story will be more generative, but I can never know for sure. There is always a bet made by the person.
Are you going to tell us what you mean by schmuckiness?
Yes. Okay. Because schmuckiness is an addition to the story. And important addition to the story, I think, and it comes back to Tim's concern about advanced solipsism. The original claim was you add Tim's characterization, generativity.
Could you say what that is?
Yes. The basic reason why, as far as I'm concerned, you teach the theory of evolution in schools and you don't teach the story of intelligent design is because it is my bet that there will be more future stories built on the story of evolution than there will be future stories built on the story of intelligent design.
I guess you have to put some kind of constraints on those kind of stories, though, don't you?
You need some way to measure the spread, but and we could worry about the details of it, but the parallel that I'm drawing is, you know, there's no question but that mammals over the last X billions of years have radiated more than reptiles. That's what I mean by generativity. It's a comparative generativity. It's over a fixed period of time, recent past. It's a bet on a fixed period of time, the near future.
And saying that that was part of God's plan doesn't really count as...
Nothing. There has been no burst of generativity, no great diversity of new stories since 1860 along the path of intelligent design, whereas there has been an incredible burst of new stories along the path of evolution since 1860.
Yeah, but you need to have some fair measure.
I mean, people could say that they don't need any more stories.
Well,
key.
Yeah.
That's absolutely key, because the argument I make says that in order to discriminate stories, you must have a context. You will discriminate stories differently depending on your context. It's my assertion that for science, the context is an interest in new stories. For other purposes, you would make the discrimination differently. For science, the point is the creation of new stories, and therefore you discriminate between stories by making a bet on their future generativity. The ID people, intelligent design people, if they're functioning as good scientists, and I concede the possibility they are making a bet. Their bet is that by pursuing the nature of the intelligent designer, they will generate more stories than pursuing the implications of the absence of one. And goddammit, if one of those guys, next Thursday, shows the steps to heaven, and we can all walk up there and ask God what the fuck he's doing, they will have been right, and I will have been wrong.
But you could also say that they are betting that making new stories is not the way to get to heaven.
If they are not interested in the making of new stories, then in my terms, they're not doing science.
But what happens when you end up with the grand unified theory of everything and you're sort of done?
That is the possibility that is left open by my original assertions. It is possible on the assumption that you cannot measure, you cannot use truth or reality as a guide. If there is such a thing, we would still get there through the process I'm talking about. At that point, we would know we have gotten there because there are no longer any questions.
But wouldn't that what God people would say? That we're there already there?
If it's their ambition to get there, they are not functioning as scientists.
God people is a technical term.
But of course, yes. I mean, the problem is, that is now a satisfying statement for you.
Absolutely.
It's not a, they would say...
Fine. Now.
So what that you define science
good.
That way? It isn't what I define
right.
it.
I understand it.
We're
that's
back
all
to
fine.
Humpty Dumpty defining
so
science as
no,
meaning
we're
anything.
Not back
we
to anything. We are moving forward. So let me
now.
No,
move.
No, 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 no. You have to wait one minute. If all discrimination is contextual,
all discrimination is contextual, yes.
Then you really do have to stop and deal with the log of how you discriminate or identify the quantity of new stores.
No, I don't.
Yeah, you do. Because I could say, you know, sitting among the God people, we have 1,000 new stories we've generated since 1865.
I mean, if somebody wants to sit there and worry about that problem, they're welcome to. The difference in numbers and diversity of stories, if you know all the stories, is so obvious that I haven't got time to go think
about
it.
Wait, here's another, I'll throw another paradox at you at this point, and then I'll mention something that I think is actually a useful response as opposed to an obstructionist one, but I'll obstruct first. The obstructionist one would be to say that this story you're offering is actually non-generative, because what it does is it makes a distinction between science and non-science, which, if someone follows your logic seriously, is actually private, interior, and satisfying mostly to you. In other words, that most scientists would not accept the distinction you propose as explaining to them the distinction which exists. Most people who aspire to the label of scientists, but whom scientists frequently wish to discriminate. So the paradox is that it is a story which, by the rule of discrimination you propose, ought to be discriminated against because it's non-generative.
No, for exactly the same reason that the ID people are all right. I cannot know how generative the story actually
is in advance.
I can only place a bet.
I
and
would
what
place
I'm
a bet against
get
it.
To, what I'm going to get to, if we get there, is a consideration of how generative this story actually is.
Okay. I would place
but
a bet
agree,
against it.
Absolutely. You can bet against it. I'm betting for it. Neither one of us can know.
We cannot know in advance. I agree with that. That's the point that comes
I'm
back.
Not
and
even
so
sure, though, after the fact we can agree on whether
now,
your story
is
or
this is where I would propose the thing that we could know that would be worth studying that is actually very poorly studied across a fairly broad span of inquiry and yet I think can be studied, is interesting to study, and we could tell interesting stories about, and that is failure. And with one of the things that we don't know very well in a great many systems that have evolutionary or cumulative character is about stories that fail. I mean, I've been really interested in this with the history of advertising. We know a lot about successful advertising campaigns, and from those, many different competing schools of people make claims about why advertisements
Absolutely.
Succeed. But they rarely, if ever, pay any attention to ad campaigns that exist, can be seen to exist, and yet fail in some very significant way to propagate. In general, I would say with a lot of networks, with a lot of these kinds of systems that have these complex characters, we don't pay very much attention to failure. In evolution, I think people do more, but even there, we don't necessarily, if we're talking about the fossil record, because by their very definition, organisms that are short-lived, you know, unsuccessful, catastrophically wiped out in a very short period of time, et cetera, may not leave fossil records.
Sure.
It's the whole thing that led to
absolutely.
The
tipping
point.
Let me.
Hume's argument in the scientific revolution
exactly.
books that all the stories that failed get erased from the science textbooks and only get
this
That's
is
right.
all true, and this is all very interesting, and I think it would, in fact, along the lines of this story, be useful to undertake studies not only of why things fail, but why other things are generative.
Yeah.
However, having said that, I would regard lines of research that look into the general question, why do some things fail, or the general question, why are some things generative, as a new set of stories motivated by the story.
You could claim that for your bet. I agree.
Okay, now, but having said that, I also assert that the story implies that while these additional stories can be productively pursued, they cannot, in fact, end the discussion.
No, I agree with that.
For a reason that is closely related to schmuckiness.
Okay. Now I want to hear it.
Oh, cool.
So let
Something
me
new.
Get you to schmuckiness.
All right. Let's hear schmuckiness.
On the way to schmuckiness, let me just note, in passing, that in addition to this notion of generativity, there was also a notion of dread in the earlier discussion. When you're making a bet as a scientist, you bet not only, you bet ultimately on generativity, but you also use as a component of how you make that bet the spread of things which go into the story and the breadth of the likely impact. Okay? So there's a parameter in the betting process which is concerned with breadth.
Is that interconnectivity and strength of interconnectivity?
Yes, if you like.
Because
yeah.
I mean,
or it is the same as the motivation for the great theory of everything. I mean, you bet that if you're close to something which summarizes a wide array of things, you're likely to come up with a more generative story. So in addition to generativity, there's also a consideration of breadth and motivation.
I think that's...
Now, where do we get the schmuckiness? It is my assertion that if one is actually making one's bets in any place that's really interesting, like really interesting, you cannot rely on any existing understanding as a good guide for the bet. That is, for really interesting bets, the only thing you've got to rely on is your gut. Your gut is a better guide in situations of highly complex, indeterminate probability than is any existing system that's verbalizable or rationalizable, including your own.
And that's exactly what people say about people, though.
That's what I want to argue is as essential a component of this process as anything else. It is a recognition of what I will call informed schmuckiness. It is actually the unconscious that is capable of integrating over very wide and indeterminate ways, arrays of stuff, in a way that the storytelling part of the brain, the verbal part, the logical part, the idea part, is not capable of doing. And so in the last analysis, the essential element of betting on generativity is informed schmuckiness. If, in fact, you use any system at all which you can verbalize, your likelihood of hitting the inspired bet is less.
Yeah, but notice that this is, I mean, this is the stuff that...
And it is solipsism,
Gladwell, sort of. Now, I was just going to say that it's not, maybe. This is the stuff that Gladwell is summarizing in Blink. I mean, all the research on intuition and, in a sense, snap reasoning and things like that. One of the things that a lot of that work turns on is the assertion that what lets many people act on intuition effectively from the gut is not solipsism, but in fact the aspect of human intelligence that's very good at reading and inferring the states of other intelligences around it. In other words, if this is about intuition or your gut telling you what things are likely to be most generative, it's actually about a cognitive model of A, what other people around you are likely to do, and B, what the systems, the social systems around you are likely to propagate.
I have no argument with.
So it's not really actually about what satisfies you at all.
I have no problems at all with the notion that among the bits of information that the unconscious is using is other people's stories, what other people think, what other people's reactions are. No problem. That's all in there. I simply do not regard that as the totality of what's in there.
Well, I agree with that, but I think, all right, I'll give you an example of an actually existing case, if you will accept that provisional truth claim for a moment, that I think speaks to the whole framework you're setting out, but also disturbs it. There's a book called The Cheese and the Worms. I don't know, has anybody else here read it? Like one of my all-time favorites. Words of history. By an Italian historian named Carlo Ginzburg, and he's a pretty well-known quote-unquote micro-historian. I mean, he's very interested in individuals, individual circumstances, idiosyncratic histories. Mostly works on early modern. Like stories. Very big. But he, in this book, what he did is he it's about a miller named Minocchio, who lived in northern Italy in the early modern era. Minocchio lived in a small town. He happened to teach himself to read.
This is supposedly a true story?
It's a true story. By idiosyncratic methods, he learned to read. He began through all sorts of different ways, including a lot of blinds and sort of, you know, orders that he could hide behind, assembling printed material in an era when the printing press was really just getting rolling. The Bible, but lots of other things. He, on the floors of his mill house, which he saw nobody, he was notoriously antisocial in this community, he began constructing charts and diagrams of the way he thought the universe was. He began writing his own cosmology. It is close to like reading the account of an alien. I mean, when Ginzburg cites it, it's nearly incomprehensible to outsiders. It was intensely private. Now, it was clearly a story which was generative to him, persuasive to him, satisfying to him in all these ways. In other words, if we take him living in that house by himself with his only input being all these books he's ordering, his output is an incredibly elaborative system that every time he constructed one step in it, it clearly made him think of a new step. It was deeply unpersuasive to anybody else and non-generative. When finally the fact that he was ordering all these books and doing all this became somewhat public knowledge, because he couldn't conceal it forever, the Inquisition took an interest in him, tortured him, got him to confess, brought all these materials, and executed him. And then all the materials are known later to Ginzburg because the Inquisition files have them. I mean, so this is a guy who, in one sense, is nicely described by this. He's a storyteller. He gets a hold of stories and makes a new story. It's a beautiful solipsistic case of generativity. But of course, his story's non-generative to anybody else.
It's the breath.
That's the end of it.
It's the breath.
So he has bet badly. That's all.
Okay, but the point is, the badness of his bet has to do with something beyond himself.
It's the lack of breath of life.
The actual demonstration of generativity.
Which is an interpersonal, intersubjective.
Always, absolutely. No,
survival of the fittest.
Yeah, it's
type
just
of
like you know. It's just like a new species on the earth. A new species on the earth does not have a promise of generativity, independent of the other species existing at the time.
That's part of the test of generativity.
But then you're not talking
point.
About developing a story that's only pleasing to you.
I never said I was talking about a story developing.
I was providing a set
of criteria that can be used to make a bet on generativity.
The final test is generativity. Have to go beyond the proposition that its generativity is a thing which cannot be described in some kind of probabilistic relationship to what it really or really is not.
You cannot say at any given time what the generativity will be. You can only make a bet on the generativity.
But I would say your bet is based on something more than a solipsistic model in your own consciousness. It is based, in fact, on a cognitive capacity that you have that is quote-unquote real for judging other intelligences, the world around you, the social systems.
No argument.
Right.
All I'm saying is that mess, which is being used to make the bet, is in fact not describable by you or anybody else in any formal system. If it were describable in any formal system, then it would not be a good basis for this bet.
It
is, that
not
is to say
finally
you are,
or completely describable.
Yes.
Sure.
Absolutely.
But that you're making this, you have, here you have the same problem that, the highly principled and formal Derridians have, which is to say, because things cannot be described finally or in absolute terms, they refuse to undertake any description. In other words, I would say, yes, absolutely, you cannot finish a description. Communication does always have slippage. There is no way to, you know, remove the difference between the sign and the signifier and that kind of thing. But
fine.
Absolutely. But
notice,
doesn't mean
though,
that you don't you cannot give any description whatsoever, and then therefore you can actually say why the gut, in a sense, can be good or bad at making predictive judgments about what's likely to
absolutely
be generated.
And notice that the whole process that I'm engaging in is fundamentally non-Derridian, which is to say the process I'm engaging in is the process of trying to figure out, to the extent
right
I usefully can, what in fact is going on in the gut.
I agree, but then therefore you don't need to have these moments of
revelation,
absolutist scrupulism, you know, about not saying certain things.
I think,
in other words, it's not such a big deal to say, I can't tell you for sure and in some final way how this or why this works, but I certainly can tell you some interesting things that are more true than other things.
It is, in fact, very fundamental to the program that people are reluctant to act in ways that they cannot fully justify. And the reluctance of people to act in ways that they cannot fully justify, I'm arguing, is in fact undesirable and paralyzing. That to make the argument cleanly and neatly, that being able to act without being able to defend oneself is in fact central to the whole emergence process. To the extent that systems of thought inhibit people from acting unless they can defend themselves, one is in fact retarding the emergence process.
I guess, okay, well, here's what I'm, in a sense, what I would suggest about a lot of this is, I think this is another example of revivifying the corpse of modernism in order to kill it again. In other words, this is a complaint about a model of the individual acting in the world that requires a sovereign, independent, rational individual who can be gotten to act in a way that is in accordance with some final sovereign individual rationality. I think that in a sense we don't need to keep killing that over and over again. I think we are post that. In other words, we're in an era where it is safe to say that agency is expressed always within a whole set of constraints, you know, that that include knowledge of self and society that are always inevitably forever probabilistic and non-final. And that consciousness is, in a sense, mythic in many of the ways that we understand it, that, et cetera. I mean, in other words, I think we can get to a point where we can say there is still agency, there is still action, there is still deliberation, there is still will. There are still things that we want to do and can explain why we want to do them, and there are things that we don't want to do, and we can explain why we don't want to do them. But that they don't require, we don't have to kind of constantly struggle against a mid to early 20th century idea of what individuals are and what societies are, and to get past them. I mean, I think we can safely assume that that job is sort of done. And now the task is, in a way, how to go forward in a fuzzier logic of agency, action, society, and so on. So, I mean, let's kill the prolegomenon and say we are already there. We already recognize that, in fact, we are really fuzzy. How do you make a fuzzy statement about the fact that things are fuzzy is really the problem. But
in fact, having done all of that, what I wanted to move on to, which is what you can do with this, is it generative? Does it create new stories? And for that purpose, I wanted to use a little reflection into a course of biology that I've been teaching recently, but also a new exhibit on Serendip called The Novelist of a Neurobiologist, which results from a writer at Ohio State University writing to me saying, geez, I hit a writer's block on a particular article, essay that I was writing. Can you help me with the writer's block? And that led him to an exchange between her and me about the nature of storytelling. Some interesting implications that come out of that, which then lead on to go further questions and further stories. There's a comparable case with an art historian who became concerned about an article she was writing about a performance artist. And that, too, that one's not yet available, but will be shortly. In both cases, it turns out that the crux of what they were concerned about actually has to do with story and the nature of story. And in both cases, the challenge offered now, not from biology, but in one case from art history, and another case from novelism, literature, proved, in fact, to illuminate the continuing development of the story of stories. And that's where we would have gone. That you're welcome to have a peek at it.
I will. I think, to me, the programmatic statement that one can make after having gone through this process is that the exploration that we are now engaged in is an elaborate version of the old maxim, give me the wisdom to know what I can control and the wisdom to accept what I cannot, except that I would addendum it by saying, and give me an interest in understanding the things that I cannot. But it means, you embrace in the domain, let's say, of social policy, the possibility that there are a great number of things which will, that are strange attractors in the human future, and you stop worrying about those at the level that old-style rationalist social planning did. It wanted to manage those out of existence. You embrace them not only as inevitabilities, but as interesting, because they'll be neither good nor bad, they'll just be different. But you also don't abandon those things which it is possible to imagine having an agentive control over. I mean, so I think there's a fuzzy space we can get to that is a satisfying aphoristic description of what our obligations are, and that make clear some of the boundaries between the things which are still amenable to being
I have no
controlled by will
all,
and agency.
I would say that the bottom line of all of this is not to assert that there are some things which can never be known, but indeed to say those things which are not at the moment known should be looked into. No argument at all. What this does say, though, is that the process of looking into them is fundamentally process.
Yes.
It is not movement towards the goal. That's the key point. What this
I'm not
says,
happy with that.
I know you're not happy with it. That's why
I'm happy with the Zeno's paradox version of it, which is to say you go halfway there and halfway there and halfway there and you never get there.
That has the Popper problem.
Yes,
you really want either a goal or a continual process of approximating to a goal.
Could we next week do the bio course and then the novelist? Isn't she really in the memoirs, not a novelist?
She's both.
Yeah, but in the things she sent you, what did
the thing she sent me was a memoir.
Okay, so that's nicely literate, but it's wrong. But maybe we should do biology.
The memoirist and the memoir.
I would be happy to do
and the
biology of the novel.
As a, like a concrete example.
Absolutely.
Of whether this story works or not.
Sure. And if the art historian gets back to me between now and next week, we can throw her onto the list.
But it might be good to actually try it out in your context.
Let's
see how useful it is.
Here, here.
I've been going to these Anthony Appiah talks, and he's doing
trolley
problem,
yeah.
You know, that the five people are
going
to die, and then the question is, do you flip the switch to kill one person, or do you actually push a 300-pound man? How much do you weigh?
260.
I was just, while you were here trying to stop the train, I kept having this image of this 300, because then one of the questions was, why don't you just throw yourself on the train track instead of making
right.
somebody else stop the train? What about self-sacrifice? And I just, it seemed to me,
yeah, just
all that
himself
inaccurate. I know. I know. And actually, he stopped the train,
well,
I would say.
That's the point, is if you're heavy enough, you can do that without fear, right?
Well, that's what I was thinking. Weight will...
Of course, there are people that just blow up the train track.
Some guy walking into a locker room and... these are something outrageous. But he was, Sam said, but he was big. He weighed 350 pounds. And he could say anything he wanted.
Right.
And I sort of thought,
where does the 800-pound gorilla sleep? Where he wants.
What was the Italian cosmologist?
Oh, it's a great book, The Cheese and the Worms by Carlo Ginzburg, and the Miller's name is Minocchio.
Minocchio.
It's actually a really beautiful book. I mean, it's sad, too.
Well, I think that's your biggest challenge, is this Minocchio paradox. If you're so self-generative...
No,
because
he has breath in there. That's not the...
I mean, he may have been right, right? It may have turned out that all of
there have been lots of forms of life tried out, which, if they had been tried out in some other context, would have been very successful.
Here's what I'm saying, is I think you just...
Right, what would life would have been like if hallucinogenia had not died in the...
Just don't forget to reemphasize the collectively validated, predictably powerful, reconcilable part.
That's all in there.
If you keep that all in there, I think
it's... Tim put it all in there. It's all in there.
Yeah, but he also has...
But the point is...
Yeah, with subversive intent, I'm trying to get reality.
All
right.
Pretty obvious.
Affecting your story. All right, see ya.
Okay, so... Paul, you want to continue next week?
Or try.
And Anne and Will?
Yeah, whenever it's fun. We're,
okay.
We're working
You're
on
flexible.
It. It's far enough along we can
do it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.